So I would like to end this series of presentations of the poetry of Sri Aurobindo. By going back to the beginning, in a way, where we learned that for him there was the possibility of a new poetry that would build on the lyrical movement of the poet, the basic movement of poetry, but it would add a depth of intuition and a breadth of vision that would make it possible to communicate realities that come from the highest planes of consciousness, overmind truths. And so in those early days when he wrote about the theory of poetry, he emphasized power and beauty. As the primary objects of poetry, to express power and beauty. And delight. But the type of poetry which traditionally is the most powerful and the most beautiful is the epic form of poetry. And so he suggested using the structure of the epic with story and narrative and the meter of the classical epic, quantitative meter, to express these worlds of inner reality that had not been expressed through poetry. So his road, his journey from that time of writing around 1920 through the 20s and 30s and 40s was an exploration of this possibility to use all of the fine creative tools that had been developed through centuries to express realities that were not being expressed. And the element, the surprising element in this development of structure, I think, is that these traditional forms of English poetry and classical Greek and Sanskrit poetry can undergo a transformation of power and beauty through the force of mantra. the original creative speech of the Rishi, the seer. So the seer of these realities previously has used the mantric form to communicate the spiritual vision of existence. But Sri Aurobindo stated the goal of including all of existence in the scope of this mantric poetry, whose goal is to express inner realities, but not only the spiritual plane, all of reality, and to bring all of reality to the hearer, to the seer, through mantric speech. The Vedas, as we've been hearing in the Upanishads, primarily communicate spiritual powers and spiritual goals. And Savitri does that too. But in Savitri there is an inclusiveness of the world as the soul's journey towards transcendence. And so traditionally in epic poetry, power is about conquest. It is brute force. It is vital power and physical power. And it is also mental power and spiritual power. And this is distinct from beauty and delight. And it is also distinct from truth. And so if we take these four goddesses, and visualize them as creators of planes of existence, creators of all aspects of existence, everything that is beautiful embodies to some extent the divine coefficient of power, of beauty. And everything from the crawling of the snail to the conquest of Troy is an expression of power. And every bit of science and philosophy, every bit of it is an expression of truth. And every morsel of food that is swallowed by every bird and every glass of wine and sensation of breeze is an expression of delight. So the life world embodies truth, beauty, power, and delight. The physical world embodies these principles. The mental world embodies them. The over-mental world creates them. And in the divine, they are the pure thing itself. without any expression. The divine we can conceive of as truth of being, delight of being, beauty of being, power of being, and this is the eternal and absolute. So Sri Aurobindo had a vision of creating a poetry that communicates from the overmind degree of reality, plane of reality, forms of truth and power and beauty and delight through all the levels of manifestation. Because a transformation of consciousness means that we become conscious of what ordinarily seems to be, as he says, null and void, but actually is an expression of those divine degrees of absolute reality. It's our problem that we don't perceive in every iota divine power and divine beauty and delight. That's the problem of the transitional being, the evolutionary consciousness. We perceive existence in a very mundane and buffered manner. But that doesn't mean that what we perceive is what the reality is. The purpose of the transformation of consciousness is to see the divine reality in everything. And so Sri Aurobindo's idea was that a highest power of inspired speech might connect the human consciousness with the innermost truth and beauty and power and delight in everything on every plane. It can uplift everything so that the most brutal event can be perceived to be divine. Because there is nothing else. And so he, Savitri, which we've been reading and hearing for a few weeks, we know is an amalgamation of this theory for the purpose of conveying to us the yoga of transformation. Now, at the same time, and that he was formulating these ideas on the basis of his extraordinary genius and spiritual inspiration, he wrote another epic called Ilion. What is its purpose? Is it different from Savitri? Can we understand this theory of Sri Aurobindo any better and any differently through this creation? It certainly has had less publicity. We know that in the 40s he was still very interested in it. Around 1944 or 45, he commented on that. And he wrote his essay on quantitative meter during that time, in the 40s. And so he was still developing the poetry of the future. And this poem, Ilion, was still the field of his experimentation, exploration. In one of his late letters on Savitri around 1946, he says that all true poetry is exploration. its discovery. So in this poem, Ilion, which we heard a little bit from in the beginning, just to illustrate the power of quantitative hexameter, and the hexametric line is longer and much weightier than the pentametric line. It even looks, takes up more of the page, spreads across the whole page, and it requires, as he has commented, an extraordinary degree of creative power to sustain the inspiration and the expression in this form. And those who know Greek and who have understood Sri Aurobindo's close affinity to the Greek poets, Amalkiran being one of those, have recognized that Sri Aurobindo was equally a master of Greek and Latin as Sanskrit, as he was of Sanskrit, and English. And when you study Ilion, you find out all about the gods of the Greeks in great detail. Sri Aurobindo was unbelievably closely attuned to that realm of beings, those realities. And he commented somewhere that reading Homer in the original was literally to bring the gods down from Mount Olympus, to make them live. So he did it. He reincarnated the whole pantheon of Greek gods and goddesses in this book called Ilion. It's amazing. It's extraordinary. And it raises another question for me that's closely aligned with the later chapters of The Life Divine and our evolutionary exploration, where at one point Sri Aurobindo goes into a very elaborate and totally incomprehensible description of the planes above the physical, the vital, and the mental. He learned to see, and he teaches us to see our lives as a universal, physical, universal, vital, and mental existence. If we truly achieve cosmic consciousness and impersonality and detachment, then we perceive everything in terms of those universal principles of life and mind. And then he says that the life plane and the mind plane and other planes have a scope, a range, far beyond anything that is actually manifested. And so they reach into the divine vital, the range of the vital, the divine vital, and the divine mind, the higher vital and the higher mind, and touch the overmind, where the gods and goddesses that create everything that exists dwell eternally. So the idea is that we can, through a transformation of consciousness, see the reality of our world in those terms. And when we ask the question, what is time, for an overmind being who is a power of divine creation in the universe, I'm sure that our answer is going to be different than what we say about time with respect to our schedules. Which is the reality? The only way we can really understand what time is through a transformation of consciousness which allows us to attune ourselves to these overmind deities. Then we have a chance to understand really the answer to that question. And in the class on evolution, we know that human beings have discovered cyclically, time and time again, and once again in the 20th century, that there's a possibility to evolve a higher intuition, which amounts primarily to breaking through our narrow concept of time. The intuitional consciousness is a different way of perceiving time, primarily. So Bergson says, there are no moments in time. They're all products of our artificial limitations that we impose. And so things, realities have a duration. And you don't really know the reality of something unless you know its duration. And because you don't have time to get to know its duration, you tack a label on it. So one of the things that's possible, theoretically, through a mantric, epic, overmind poetry, is a glimpse of the meaning of time, the reality itself. A glimpse of the reality of power itself. A glimpse of the reality of beauty itself. More interesting than time, right? Beauty. A glimpse of the reality of love itself. So I would suggest that one of the reasons why Sri Aurobindo was preoccupied with Ilion is exactly this. He was interested in communicating these realities. And his whole experiment with poetry was to create a language that makes it possible to do that. Now, as we also learned in the early stages of this course, this is a poetry of sound. You absolutely cannot hear the meaning of Ilion by reading the page. The big question then is, how does it sound? Not what does it mean? What is the sound of the meaning of time? If it's possible to know the answer to that question, then this poem, Ilion, says it. So it's important. And it belongs to Sri Aurobindo's very particular, special art and theory of poetry. So we at least should have a grasp of it in our bank of stored impressions, which fade surprisingly quickly. And so then, fortunately, it exists on the page so that we can recover it from time to time. In the Hindu tradition, there are kavis who sit in temples and recite the entire Mahabharata from memory. And you can imagine that that would enable you to reconnect with its truths and powers and subtleties of meaning in a way that you're not likely to do in your busy schedule. We don't have kavis sitting around reading Savitri and Ilion these days, but it's not impossible that they could at some point arrive. Maybe the future poetry requires so I would like to read a few passages just to see if we can catch something surprising. With respect to these embodiments of truth and beauty seen by Sri Aurobindo and conveyed through his technique. The first character who we will see and hear is a person known as Lao Koan. Lao Koan is a prophet, and he's a Trojan prophet. And Troy is about to fall to the Greek invaders. Let's keep in mind that this is a phenomenon that has happened repeatedly throughout human history. This fall of a civilization to a conqueror for the sake of beauty, because of the immortality of beauty, Helen, who we will also meet tonight, or for the sake of wealth, Lakshmi, or for the sake of truth. These are not unknown phenomena. And in the divine scheme of things, if these realities of divine power and beauty and truth are evolving on earth through human forms, then each occurrence of the rise and the fall of a civilization, or a hero, or a romance, has a divine purpose. If we look at them that way, they aren't disasters. They are moments of temporal transition. So, here comes Laocoon. No, sorry. It's not available. It's not available. So you can relax your eyes.
No, I don't understand.
You will understand something. Please try. Then, as the shouting, tired of itself, at last disappeared in the bosom of silence, once more he started erect, and his voice o'er the hearts of his hearers swept like ocean's impatient cry when it calls from its surges. Did you understand that? Then, as the shouting tired of itself at last disappeared in the bosom of silence, once more he started erect, and his voice o'er the hearts of his hearers swept like ocean's impatient cry when it calls from its surges. Ocean, loud with a thought sublime, in its measureless marching, each man felt his heart like foam in the rushing of waters. Ilion is vanquished then. The people are tired fighting. They're depressed. Troy is falling. Ilion is vanquished then. She abases her grandiose spirit, mortal, found in the end to the gods and the Greeks and Antenor. And when a barbarous chieftain's menace and insolent mercy bring here their pride to insult the columned spirit of Ilion. Trojans have sat and feared. For a man has arisen and spoken, one whom the gods in their anger have hired. Since the Argive, the Greek sailor, prevailed not, armed with his strength and his numbers, in Troia they sought for her slayer, gathered their wiles in a voice, and they chose a man famous and honored, summoned Aeta to aid, and corrupted the heart of Antenor. He's a Trojan, and he has spoken about the hopelessness of their fight against the Greeks, and has called for their surrender. Flute of the breath of the hell witch. Always he scatters among you doubt, affliction, and weakness, chilling the hearts of the fighters. Always his voice, with its cadenced and subtle possession for evil, breaks the constant will and maims the impulse heroic. Therefore, while yet her heroes fight and her arms are unconquered, Troy in your hearts is defeated. The souls of your fathers have heard you dallying, shamefast, with vileness, lured by the call of dishonor. Such is the power Zeus gave to the winged words of a mortal. Foiled in his will, disowned by the years that stride on forever, yet in the frenzy cold of his greed and his fallen ambition, doom from heaven he calls down on his countrymen. Trojan abuses Troy, his country, extolling her enemies, blessing her slayers. Such are the gods Antenor has made in his heart's own image, that if one evil man have not way for his greed and his longing, cities are doomed, and kings must be slain, and a nation must perish. But from the mind of the free and the brave, I will answer thy bodings. Gold-hungry raven of Troy, who croakest from thy nest at her princes, only one doom irreparable treads down the soul of a nation. Only one downfall endures. 'Tis the ruin of greatness and virtue. Mourning when freedom departs from the life and the heart of a people into her room comes creeping the mind of the slave, and it poisons manhood and joy, and the voice to lying is trained, and subjection easy feels to the neck of a man who is next to the Godheads. Not of the fire am I terrified, not of the sword and its slaying. Vileness of men appalls me, baseness I fear, and its voices. Well, he succeeded in waking up his fellow Trojans to their destiny. Then there is beauty and love. Have you ever thought about Paris and Helen? Helen, Helen of Troy, Helena. It's difficult to imagine how a great nation could go to war for the beauty of a woman. But it did. And so that beauty must have been something extraordinary. What?
Also novelty, the way beauty. It was a different kind of beauty, not only physical beauty.
Well, let's say divine beauty. So listen for a minute or two, five or ten, however long we go here. Listen to Sri Aurobindo's voiced manifestation of the truth of Paris and Helen. He should know, right? Here in a chamber of luminous privacy, Paris was arming. Near him moved Helen, a whiteness divine and intent on her labor, fastened his cuirass, bound the greaves and settled the hauberk, thrilling his limbs with her touch that was heaven to the yearning of mortals. She with her hands of delight caressing the senseless metal, pressed her lips to his brilliant armor. She bowed down, she whispered, "Cuirass, allowed by the gods, protect the beauty of Paris. Keep for me that for which country was lost, and my child and my brothers." Yearning, she bent to his feet, to the sandal strings of her lover. Then, as she gazed up, changed grew her mood. For the daemon within her rose that had banded Greece and was burning Troy into ashes. Slowly a smile that was perfect and perilous over her beauty dawned like the sunlight in paradise. Strangely she looked on her lover, so might a goddess have gazed as she played with the love of a mortal. Passing an hour on the earth, ere she rose up white to Olympus. So art thou winner, Paris, yet, and thy spirit ascendant leads this Troy where thou wilt, O thou mighty one, veiled in thy beauty. First in the dance and the revel, first in the joy of the melee, who would not leave for thy sake, and repent it not, country and homestead? Winning, thou reignest still over Troy, over fate, over Helen. Always so canst thou win. Has death no claim on thy beauty? Fate no scourge for thy sins? How the years have passed by in a glory, years of this heaven of the gods, O ravisher, since from my hearthstone seizing thou borest me, compelled to the ships and my joy on the waters. Troy is enringed with spears. Her children fall and her glories. Mighty souls of heroes have gone down prone to the darkness. Thou and I abide. The mothers wail for our pleasure. Wilt thou then keep me forever, O son of Priam, in Troia? Fate was my mother, they say. And Zeus, for this hour, begot me. Art thou a god too, O hero, disguised in this robe of the mortal, brilliant, careless of death and of sin, as if sure of thy rapture? What then if fate today were to lay her hand on thee, Paris? Calmly he looked on the face of which Greece was enamored, the body for whose desire great Troy was a sacrifice. Tranquil regarded, lovely and dire, on the lips he loved that smile of a goddess, saw the daughter of Zeus in the woman, yet was not shaken. Temptress of Argos, he answered, thou snare for the world to be seized in, thou then hopest to escape, but the gods could not take thee, O Helen, how then thy will, that to mine is a captive, or how, though with battle, he who has lost thee, unhappy, the Spartan, bright Menelaus, all things yield to a man, and Zeus is himself his accomplice, when, like a god, he wills, without remorse or longing, thou on this earth art mine, since I claimed thee, behold, not speaking, but with thy lids that fell, thou veiledest thy heart of compliance. Then, in whatever beyond, I shall know how to take thee, O Helen, even as here upon earth I knew. Yes, it is good, she cried. What the gods do, and actions of mortals. Good is the play of the world, it is good, the joy and the torture. Praised be the hour of the gods when I wedded bright Menelaus. Praised, more praised. The keels that severed the seas towards Helen, churning the senseless waves that knew not the bliss of their burden. Praise to the end, the hour when I passed through the doors of my husband, laughing with joy in my heart for the arms that bore and enchained me. Never can death undo what life has done for us, Paris. Nor, whatever betide, can the hour be unlived of our rapture. So then, that's called the Book of Partings. There's a book called the Book of the Gods. And here, as Sri Aurobindo predicted in the future poetry, we have the gods themselves speaking. And in a, just a couple of pages, we have Eris, the god of war, and Aphrodite, actually, and Hera, and Zeus, and finally Cassandra, who is a mortal possessed by them. So, I'm going to just read a little bit of Zeus, Eris, and Aphrodite. In America they say Aphrodite, I don't know why. It's Aphrodite is the...
I think that's not the Greek word. Yeah.
So in the courts of heaven, August, the thunderer puissant, spoke to his sons in their souls, and they heard him, mighty in silence. Then to her brother divine, the white-armed, passionless Hera. Hera is a mother goddess who was popular throughout Greece as the goddess of the household. The goddess of sacrifice. And she was rather heartless. Then to her brother divine, she's both sister and wife of Zeus, the white-armed, passionless Hera. Zeus, we remember, thy sons forget, Apollo and Eris. Hera, queen of the heavens, they forget not, but choose to be mindless. This is the greatness of gods, that they know and can put back the knowledge. Doing the work they have chosen, they turn not for fruit nor for failure. They turn not for fruit nor for failure. Griefless they walk to their goal and strain not their eyes towards the ending. Light that they have, they can lose with a smile. Not as souls in the darkness, clutch at every beam and mistake their one ray for all splendor. All things are by time and the will eternal that moves us. And for each birth, its hour is set in the night or the dawning. There is an hour for knowledge, an hour to forget and to labor. Great Cronion, ceased, and high in the heavenly silence rose in their midst the voice of the loud, impetuous Eris, sounding far in the luminous fields of his soul as with thunder. Father, we know and we have not forgotten. This is our Godhead, still to strive and never to yield to the evil that conquers. I will not dwell with the Greeks, nor aid them, save forced by Ananka, necessity, and because lives of the great and the blood of the strong are my portion. War is my nature, and greatness and hardness, the necks of the vanquished. Force is my soul, and strength is my bosom. I shout in the battle, breaking cities like toys, and the nations are playthings of Eris. Hither and thither I shove them and throw down or range on my table. Constancy most I love, nobility, virtue, and courage. Fugitive hearts I abhor, and the nature fickle as sea foam. Now, if the ancient spirit of Titan battle is over, Tros fights no more on the earth, nor now Heracles tramples and struggles, bane of the Hydra, or slaying the centaurs, or Pelion driven. Now, if the earth no more must be shaken by Titan horse hooves, since to a pettier framework all things are fitted, consenting, yet will I dwell not in Greece, nor favor the nurslings of Pallas. The nurslings of Pallas are those who love beauty and wisdom. Apollo. I will await the sons of my loins and the teats of the she-wolf, consuls browed like the cliffs and plebeians stern of the wolf brood, senates of kings and armies of granite that grow by disaster. Such be the nation august that is fit for the favor of Ares. They shall fulfill me and honor my mother, imperial Hera. Then with an iron march they shall move to their worldwide dominion. Through the long centuries rule, and at last, because earth is impatient, slowly with haughtiness perish, compelled by mortality's transience, leaving a Roman memory stamped on the ages of weakness. Those are our ages, the ages of weakness with the stamp of the Romans on them. We don't know the meaning of courage. But in the courts divine, the thunderer spoke to his children, Ares resisting a present fate for the hope of the future, God, for the hope of the future gods has gone forth from us. Choose thou thy paths, O my daughter. More than thy brother assailed by the night that darkens o'er creatures, choose the silence in heaven, or choose the struggle mid mortals. Golden joy of the worlds, O thou roseate, white Aphrodite. Then with her starry eyes and bosom of bliss, from the immortals glowing and rosy-limbed, cried the wonderful white Aphrodite, drawing her fingers like flowers through the flowing gold of her tresses, calm, discontented, her perfect mouth a rose of resistance, chidingly budded against fate. A charm to their senses enamored. Well do I know thou hast given my world to Hera and Pallas. What though my temples shall stand in Paphos and island Cythera, and though the Greek be a priest for my thoughts and a lyre for my singing, beauty pursuing and light through the figures of grace and of rhythm, Forms shall he mold for men's eyes that the earth has forgotten and mourns for. Mold even the workings of palace to commune with Paphia's sweetness. Mold Hephaestus's craft in the gaze of the gold Aphrodite. Only my form he pursues, that I wear for a mortal enchantment. He to whom now thou givest the world, the Ionian, the Hellene. But for my might is unfit, which Babylon worshipped, and Sidon, palely received from the past in images faint of the gladness once that was known by the children of men, when the thrill of their members was but the immortal joy of the spirit overflowing in nature. Wine cups of God's desire, but their clay from my natural greatness falters, betrayed to pain. Their delight they have turned into ashes. Nor to my peaks shall he rise, and the perfect fruit of my promptings, there where the senses swoon, but the heart is delivered by rapture. Never my touch can cling to his soul, nor reply from his heartstrings. Once could my Godhead surprise all the stars and the seas of its rapture, once the world in its orbit danced to a marvelous rhythm, men in their limits, gods in their amplitudes, answered my calling. Life was moved by a chant of delight that sang from the spaces, sung from the soul of the vast, his ecstasy clasping his creatures. Sweetly agreed my fire with their soil, and their hearts were as altars. Pure were its crests, 'twas not dulled with earth, 'twas not lost in the hazes. Then when the sons of earth and the daughters of heaven together met on lone mountain peaks, or linked on wild beach and green meadow, twining embraced, for I danced on Taygetus's peaks, and o'er Ida, naked and loosing my golden hair, like a nimbus of glory, o'er a deep ecstasied earth that was drunk with my roses and whiteness. There was no shrinking nor veil in our old Saturnian kingdoms. Equal were heaven and earth, twin gods on the lap of Dion. Now shall my waning greatness perish and pass out of nature. For though the Romans, my children, shall grasp at the strength of their mother, they shall not hold the god, but lose in unsatisfied orgies. Yet what the earth has kept of my joy, my glory, my puissance, who shall but drink for a troubled hour in the dusk of the sunset dregs of my wine? Pandemian, missing the Uranian sweetness. The degree of bliss and power and joy and beauty conceived there is ungraspable by the Roman spirit, even if it conquers the Ionian. Even if the Ionian was able to grasp some degree of truth and beauty and power, nothing compared to divine potencies of rapture. Is it possible to evolve a being capable of bliss? Truth born too soon would break the imperfect earth. Sri Aurobindo speaks about overmind poetry as a vehicle to raise the consciousness of humans. He does not speak of it as human poetry. He says very clearly that the true poetry straight from the overmind is not human. But it can be a lever to raise human consciousness. Therefore, spend the time and effort to create it. But who will hear it?
Isn't it significant, the first passage you read, because people will rather hear the voice of desperation, losing it, than the positive prophet voice, even in the changing, in the going down, the voice of strength and courage and virtue is, it's not in resonance, it's the movement.
Are these real things, or are they only the dreams of a poet?
For me, what I understood in Aphrodite, the message is we have in our culture to give the children the knowledge of immortality and the divine. And I think that is one of the basic, why we are also here, to let this heaven and earth come, that you know there's a heaven, there's the support of there in our souls. We have to, as we had it in the afternoon in the Upanishad, the goal must, the concentration must be on the fire, on the soul. Yeah. And this was also the message here, that the children grown up with the knowledge of immortality and all this. This was really the culture before. And I think this is missing. We are talking about past and every other thing, computers, everything, but not, and I mean, that's why I'm happy that we had these classes here to come a little bit to nourish this flame, yes. But we hang very much in the outside thing, not the essence. I mean, you know, we must always to remember us and ours that this is the soul, this is...
Well, according to this point of view, I believe that what we do or don't do doesn't make a lot of difference. It's going to take more divine influence It's going to require ages of time, quality time, not empty, meaningless time, or futile, frittered away time, but ages of quality time, of inspired time, to restore a sense of the divine. Unless there is a sudden fiat of heaven that decides to, well, maybe it already did, there was a sudden fiat which decided to, and so we can feel and we can hear and occasionally be invaded by a touch of a vibration which is quite other than our normal physical, vital, mental energy. And maybe that fiat was great enough to allow in the influences of creativity and beauty and power. And maybe it will require more ages of loosening the tent poles, as Savitri says, towards the end. There's a certain kind of effort which it says towards the end of Savitri, which we heard last time, that does loosen the tent poles. But are we willing to loosen the tent poles? We are a very small nucleus.
It doesn't matter. We are very small, it's fine. But unconsciously, just live or consciously to reflect it, it's trying.
I think through this drama, I'm thinking of Sarasa's theory in Indian. They say that all the different emotions, they were so to say, placed in the rasas, which we can re-feel. Mm-hmm. And I was just reading the other day something of Augustinus, who said, so strange when we hear all these records, and that it, something touches in us, we are not getting so sad like it would be in life, but we can hear something about it, and that is the rasas. And Sri Aurobindo has used this, I think, and put his divine elements through it so that this. We remember this peak, since the magic, and through this we can feel something deeper. And I think that is the magic about it.
So. And many are inspired by it.
Yeah.